Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Eric Olson. It is time once again for America's Most Haunted Radio special, extra special, super show tonight with documentary filmmakers Josh Zeman and Rachel Mills of Chiller's forthcoming Killer Legends. But before we talk to them, let's say hello to the world-famous Haunted Housewife, Teresa Argy. Good evening, Teresa.
Good evening, Eric. Good evening to our guests who we'll be speaking to momentarily. This is going to be a great show. New show coming out on Chiller. I can't wait to see it. Unfortunately, I did not get to see it yet, but I am looking forward to doing so. And I think that our audience is going to love it. This is right up our alley. I love this stuff. Scare the children with it.
Even more than it might seem just based on the fact that it's creepy stuff and it's where real-life crime meets urban legend and sort of teasing out that line and those demarcations. Because, in a sense, that's a lot of what we did, or at least that was our goal for the America's Most Haunted book. It's taking all those haunted locations and learning the stories and the legends and the myths behind the hauntings, and then trying to really figure out what of these are true, objectively true anyway, in the real world, which are historically true. So as I was watching this, which I literally just finished, of course, a minute ago, because that's how my brain works, it just kept occurring to me, wow, you know, what a fantastic job, what a dramatic, excellent presentation of getting behind these stories and digging into it. And even though most of them have a pretty large time remove, I mean, we go back all the way to the 40s for one of them, it feels so immediate and so real. So let's say hello to our guests, Josh Zeman and Rachel Mills.
Hey.
Hey, what's going on?
Boy, Rachel, you just made it. I said your name, you were there.
I don't know why, you know?
It was like I summoned you.
That's right, you did. I didn't exist before you mentioned me.
Hi, Rachel. I reached through the phone and grabbed you. Killer clown style.
Oh, exactly. Scary.
All right, well, let's talk about the film, and I guess I can give a little bit of background. I don't want to give too much away. I'd much rather hear it from you guys, but the basics are on this Sunday, March 16th at 8 p.m. Eastern, Chiller, which really needs an HD channel, starting to irritate me, Chiller debuts its new two-hour special, Killer Legends. The horror documentary follows filmmakers Josh Zeman and Rachel Mills as they investigate the true crimes behind these urban legends while exploring how the myths evolved and why we continue to believe. The documentary probes the following legends: the Candyman, ooh, I need my glasses, the Babysitter and the Man Upstairs, the Hookman, and the Killer Clown. Boy, these are all such archetypal figures. How did you decide which ones to do?
Well, I think a lot of it was going back and looking at which urban legends, you know, had some form of truth behind them. And a lot of our urban legends, I mean, that's the fun thing. And that's the interesting thing about these urban legends, is finding the ones that have some form of truth behind them. And all of them do have some truth behind them. But what makes an urban legend is that although it's true, there's some question about what really happened. There needs to be some part of it that's unanswered, and it's the unanswered part which allows us to create these urban legends.
I think you're absolutely right, and I also want to say that in addition to the drama and the information, and even additionally, the very easy rapport between the two of you as the sort of investigators and hosts, you both are very watchable, very likable. You're so good, you almost disappear, if you know what I mean.
Oh, that's good. Glad to hear that.
Into the stories. But what I was going to say is there's a lot of really actually very deep and perceptive kind of socio-cultural analysis that you get into. And I think ultimately I was kind of thinking by the end of it, and man, that was 2 hours that went really quickly. I thought, all right, I'll check it out. I'll watch the first one. That'll give me a sense of it. You know, I never read the whole book before I interview authors. I like to read maybe half or even
right.
two-thirds. I don't want to know the ending, you know, because I don't want to give it away. And it's often the case either for by design or just my schedule. You know, I don't finish a TV show or even a movie before I'm talking to people. But, man, this one, once I sat down, I was like, all right, well, I guess I'm not working out tonight. Yeah, no guitar practice, but I love this movie.
That's great. I love to hear it.
Yeah, it's amazing. Well, why don't we back up a little bit? Let's back up to not just how you selected these four, but just the idea for the film in the first place and how you guys came together.
Well, you know, doing, you know, my previous film is Cropsey, and, you know, I did a tour of Cropsey, and every place that I went and spoke to people, everybody wanted to not just talk about that film, but talk about their own, not just their own urban legends that occurred in their own hometowns, but also just the truth behind some of our most famous urban legends. And as you say, it's more than just the story, and it's more than just the things that scare us. These urban legends go back 50, 60, 70 years. These are stories which have been ingrained in our culture. And these are stories which Hollywood keeps pushing over and over and over again, whether it's the Amityville story, whether it's, you know, Red Riding Hood, whether it's Hansel and Gretel. Hollywood keeps pushing these stories. But the question is, how did they start and why are they so, as they say in urban legends, sticky? Why do they continue to be with us? And that's what's really exciting to me. You know, why do these stories, you know, again, like hit this, forgive me, Jungian or Freudian kind of psychology? And what is it about these urban legends that continue to stay with us? And that's, you know, the most interesting thing about it. You know, there's so much history ingrained in it, and there's so much stuff that, like, I always say it's like, let's learn about your nightmares. Let's learn about what really scares you. And that's what we do when we go back and we investigate these urban legends.
Structurally, obviously it works out well for a two-hour show to do 4 half-hours. Which came first? Did you say these are the four stories and we need about a half-hour each on them? Or did you figure it was going to be 2 hours and then it was kind of dividing from there? How did the structure come together?
Well, I figured, funny enough, we could have gone probably 45 minutes on each of them. I mean, there's so much more than actually is in there, and that's the unfortunate part. Like, even going into, like, The Hook for a Hand and how it relates to the town of Texarkana, where some believe that originally happened. But it's also understanding Texarkana itself. This town has had this urban legend for years, and because of the crime that's happened there, the town almost has their own offshoot of the same Hook urban legend, which has become the Phantom. And now with the movie that's coming out, you know, The Town That Dreaded Sundown, you know, they're doing a remake of it. It's almost like the town keeps it's like they're lost in Groundhog Day. They keep having these urban legend come back over and over, and that was so exciting to us. So I don't know, you know, I guess we had the time constraint of having to do it within feature length, and we just cut it down until the point where it fit. But man, we could have gone on for hours. I mean, clowns, how can you talk about the history of clowns in a half an hour?
And I don't want to give away too much because, I mean, there's definitely, in some sense, a conclusion, results that you guys find. I mean, some more than others, but, you know, I don't want to give away too much on it. But the way the film runs, it's not really the answer that's important. It's how did you get there? And so I don't think we're, you know, giving too much away. But again, I don't want to do that myself. I'll leave it up to you guys. But I was really interested and very impressed with the kind of the underlying answer that you guys came up with there right at the end of the clown section, because, you know, as someone who is who's going through all of this material, what I do in particular, we're finally having a website launch, and looks like it'll even be as soon as this week, so we're very excited about that because it's kind of the last piece of our puzzle. We have the social media, we do this radio show, and we've written this book that'll be out in September called America's Most Haunted. But, you know, researching all this for the social media just to give people a reason to come to us, you know, and to spread the word about the brand. Plus, it's just fun. So we do a lot of research, and I get, you know, all these Google alerts on, you know, 70, 80 different topics that are very broadly paranormal. And, man, there's always something going on about clowns. And anytime I post anything about clowns, people lose their minds. Ah, clowns are so creepy. Oh, I hate them, blah, blah, blah. You know, on and on. I mean, they just have this visceral reaction. And I think that really has changed because I just don't remember. I'm sure I'm older than you guys, but, you know, I really do remember watching Bozo as a kid. And I didn't have any fear of Bozo, and I didn't have any fear of Ronald McDonald. There wasn't even the creep factor for me. I was growing up basically, I guess, in the 60s and into the mid-70s. So, you know, I noticed the timeline is when some of these things really started happening as far as the clowns, it was the 70s. And I think that's, you know, from there is where things started changing. But again, as you say, the conclusion that you guys come to is it's a much longer timeline than that. And the clown, the real archetype of the clown, I don't know, can we give this away or not? I'll leave it to you guys.
No, absolutely. Go for it.
Yeah, is the jester, is the Joker.
Mm-hmm.
Did you guys use the word trickster? Because he's that too, right, isn't he?
Of course.
So historically, and again, we're talking about a figure that goes back thousands of years. I mean, you know, to the deepest human history. We're talking about a figure with a very strong dark side. He was there to amuse. He's there to provide, in a sense, some sarcasm-based or parody-based humor or even enlightenment, but he's got a mean streak. And I mean, I guess it goes back to Loki, right? I mean, we're talking about Norse mythology. You know, very, very divided figure. And the clown is the modern representation of that. I was very impressed with the depth of your perception, you guys.
Well, thanks. I mean, that's what it really is. I mean, it's kind of interesting how, again, I go back to Hollywood, like, you know, we hear all these stories about clowns, and, like, it really doesn't go back as far as we go back, and that's kind of, like, what we like to do. We like to take the Hollywood story and say, hey, listen, you know, they're every Friday night, you go to the theater, you get scared by it, but what's it really about? And, you know, clowns was something that we found. It was a reaction. It was the fact that we tried to sanitize the clown. We tried to make him, you know, something that he wasn't. He wasn't all happy and Ronald McDonald and Bozo. He wasn't, you know, it wasn't all about that. He was a slightly mean and freaky and weird guy. And, you know, you had to take the good with the bad. And in a lot of ways, that was what happened. And it's so interesting that you talk about clowns that way, because clowns really do provoke this kind of visceral reaction. And what is that about? Why is that? And you know, I like to say that clowns have become the penultimate villain in our modern-day culture. I mean, who's worse than the Joker? Nobody. You know, the Joker is chaos. And, of course, you know, we see that, unfortunately, come about in very real terms with, you know, Holmes, who enacted, you know, all the mass shooting at the Batman screening. I mean, this guy has taken, you know, this archetype character who's been sanitized and made him, you know, the worst of the worst. And so clowns, it really speaks to something deep inside us. There's a reason people have such fear of it. And to me, that's one of the most interesting of the urban legends that we look at. Why did clowns become creepy? How did that happen? And as you say, when you speak about clowns, people just have this crazy, crazy reaction.
They really do. And you brought up another point that runs throughout the film or even a process, and that is this interplay between pop culture and real life and how they influence each other almost in this ping pong kind of manner, like especially the Texarkana thing, where apparently the new film, the remake of The Town, is actually playing on the much more modern fact that they show the old version of the movie, outdoors, I guess, actually in the park where these killings took place. That's weird, first of all, in the first place.
I mean, that's the whole thing. But basically what all these ghost hunter shows are doing is they're doing this thing called legend tripping. And we all know legend tripping. It's just a name that maybe you haven't heard of, but it's where you go back to the site of some horrific thing that supposedly happened in your neighborhood, in your hometown, and you go and you say, you know, you go back to the location of the accident that happened with the school bus of kids. You go back to the location where you saw those headlights. You go back to the location where the house burnt down. You go back to the location where all these people were killed. And that's legend tripping. You go back to these places as teenagers and adults. You do it to be scared. You do it to test your own resolve. You do it to excite yourself. And so the funny thing is in Texarkana, literally you have a whole town going out to the place where the murders happen, which is in a place called Spring Lake Park, where the murders happen, and they show the movie there. And so literally what the town is doing is they're collectively legend tripping in this area. And then some Hollywood comes in and says, well, let's make a movie about that. Let's make a movie about the town collectively legend tripping, and of course we're going to have a copycat that comes out of this. And that was so fascinating to me. Nobody quite knew, you know, when you step back and look at it from a folklore standpoint, nobody kind of understood that that's what the town was doing. They were engaging in this thing called legend tripping. And then from that, you know, Ryan Murphy, of course, decided to make this movie from it. And what's so interesting is that, you know, myself and Ryan Murphy, we have this very interesting interplay as well. He did the second season of American Horror Story is very much taken from Cropsey, which is very nice of him to kind of make. And so we kind of like wanted to, you know, kind of speak back to him and call back to him a little bit by talking about the movie that he made about The Town That Dreaded Sundown. And what's so interesting to me about The Town That Dreaded Sundown is it was directed by a guy named Charles B. Pierce. Now, Charles B. Pierce made a movie called The Legend of Boggy Creek. And if you go and you watch that film, you'll understand that that is the precursor to the Blair Witch. So we're talking about an urban legend, The Hook, and we're talking about maybe one of the real cases that happened about it, which is the Phantom Killer. But we're also talking about a director who has been able to take a real story and make it seem real for the audience, much in the same way that Blair Witch seems quite real to the people. And that's what was so fascinating about it. You're talking about an urban legend, which is almost, we talk about it like the snake eating the tail. You know, where does the urban legend start and the truth begin? Or where does the truth begin and the urban legend start? And in some ways, nobody quite knows. And that's what I find so interesting.
Well, it's like a hall of mirrors.
Uh-huh.
Rachel, we haven't heard much from you, and you're very much a key part of the film and say many interesting and insightful things yourself. What's your take on the process of making the film and what interested you in it, just to get started talking to you?
You know, the thing that most interested me was actually finding these stories to be able to tell urban legends through. We use these true crimes as a lens, pretty much, to tell these urban legends, and actually talking to the people on the ground, the real people who were affected by the tragedies that happened in their community, and to talk to them. And, I mean, that's really how stories and tragedies are kind of taken in a community, and really it's a way for them to process it. So, you know, something really bad happens in a town, you know, a babysitter is slain at the age of 13, brutally raped and murdered, you know, and though we can't pinpoint that back to, you know, the babysitter and the man upstairs, we go there and we're able to, I want to say, intelligently talk about the urban legend of the babysitter and the man upstairs. At the same time, we're talking about these things that happen to very real people in these small communities, mostly small communities. And that's what really got me, are these connections to these actual real stories.
And what you both clearly recognized is that these stories have such deep and archetypal feeling. You know, there's millions, certainly thousands anyway, of horrific crimes that are committed all the time. But only certain ones really connect and become part of the culture, and certainly all these have. Teresa, I know you know an awful lot just of your own accord, because this is so much your area of interest, or among your areas of interest. So I'm sure you have some thoughts and some questions.
Hi, Rachel. Hi, Josh. It's
hey.
Teresa.
Hey.
You know, the first thing that stuck in my mind, and I'm probably going to give away my age here, but these stories that you did this film about are the ones from my childhood that kind of molded how I react to real-world fear. Being like summer camp, I remember hearing the stories of the Hook Man, and of course we're in Northeast Ohio, but I would swear that happened in Northeast Ohio because it was a local legend. And I'm sure that happens, you know, everywhere. But, you know, as an 8-year-old out at sleepaway camp, that kept me up at night thinking about this Hook Man was going to come and get me, and babysitting. I didn't want to babysit when I was young because I remember the word about the babysitter. But my first time that I ever realized that monsters were real was when John Wayne Gacy was discovered and caught, and that whole incident happened. I remember that vividly. It was John Wayne Gacy, and it was also the Jamestown incident, Jimmy Jones, and
Jonestown.
Those two made me realize that men can be monsters, and that was even more terrifying than the local clown, which I thought, there's a reason they're hiding behind that makeup. There's something wrong with that. So, I mean, these stories resonate with people. They resonate with people, even if you don't believe in ghosts, even if you don't like scary stories, because they have such a touch of reality. And I like that you guys have gotten into this and discovered where these myths come from, because I'll tell you, and you probably did this in your research, you talk to people in any town, any small town in America, and they'll say, oh, yeah, that happened here. That's based on an incident that happened in our town, or I know somebody that this happened to, and this person was affected by that. And whether the legend actually came from one incident or different incidents that happened all over, that is just, it's terrifying, and it's kind of scary to know that how it can really be related to just about anybody in any part of the country, maybe even many parts of the world. So
yeah.
I know that that's what hit me as a young person and really terrified me and kept that fear in me, and that, you know, it makes you a little bit leery. What was the reaction to the people you interviewed when you were doing this film? I mean, Was this something that did a lot of people just say, no, that's just an urban legend, or did they really believe it? Did they have knowledge of it? I mean, I'm wondering what the people's reactions were when you were actually filming and researching for this.
Rach did a lot of the research. Rach, why don't you tell how it was when, you know, you spoke to these people on the phone for the first time?
Yeah, I mean, did they say it was real? They think it was nonsense? Did they believe these stories? How did they react to this? Did they think it was just, you know, just a scary story? Did they realize it had a basis in reality?
I mean, that's the thing. As I was approaching it, I separated those two things. I separated the urban legend and the true crime because, you know, for me, using the true crime aspect of it was an ability to be able to talk to the urban legend. You know, we can sit here and say, you know, hook for a hand definitely started in Texarkana. You know, definitely started the first, you know, case of teenagers dying on being killed on Lover's Lane, but we can't say for certain. You know what I mean? So I couldn't approach, and I was a person who was researching all of these cases and trying to find some cases that resonated as far as the urban legend being able to be a light to be shown on the urban legend through these true crimes. So, you know, when I was approaching it, I wasn't talking to these people, these people who experienced real tragedy. You know what I mean? I think it would have been a little bit dishonest of me to talk to a woman whose very good friend was killed brutally. You know, it's not something that I started with, but once we got on the ground, you know, and I developed a relationship with these people and gained their trust, I think that, you know, once we did start talking about babysitting, you know, it is a real for young women. And it was a real fear for young women in the community of Columbia, Missouri at that time in 1950, between 1946 and 1950.
Yeah, or even, like, speaking to the police officers about Gacy, you know,
mm-hmm.
like, they understood how creepy the clown aspect was. And, you know, you have to approach it, you know, that's what we do. We approach these things not just from, like, you know, a kind of a gleeful sense, but we approach them from quite real. And we think that's what actually works in
mm-hmm.
our discussions of these true crimes and urban legends. So, you know, in the same breath that we're having a conversation with the prosecutor about Gacy, how they found 33 bodies underneath the house, he's talking about how in the court case they needed to deal with the fact that he dressed like a clown. And what was that? And why did he do that? And so and how that made him do what he did. And so I think, you know, I think what Rach and I do, and I think, you know, what makes it different is we approach these things from a very serious standpoint because people are – There's lives that we're dealing with here. And when you approach it from a serious standpoint, the urban legends take that much more gravitas. They become
mm-hmm.
actually that much more scary. And as Teresa, as you said, once you realize that they're not just scary stories, but they're quite real, then you really do understand the evil that men can do. And that's when you understand it's not necessarily about the ghost. It's about the person. It's about the real person who's did this horrific thing, and what makes that person tick? Why are they so evil, and why do they do what they do? And the other thing that you guys mentioned was, you know, the fact that makes some of these crimes become urban legends and not what we found in urban legends is that it's those crimes that for some reason have a mystery. It's those crimes that, you know, still have some lingering questions. Those are the crimes that become the urban legends because an urban legend is both true and not true. You can't really prove that it did or didn't happen. And, you know, if you don't know all the answers to the crime, that allows the urban legend to grow and that allows there to be multiple reasons and that allows you to kind of fit the urban legend to the story that you want to tell, if that makes sense to you.
Now, do you think that urban legends, is even ones as serious and as dark as the ones that your film is about, again, like I said, it's decades and decades these have resonated and they've continued and they've grown. They've changed maybe a little bit, maybe detail here or there, but they've basically stayed the same. And do you think that as an urban legend, as a storyteller, as a filmmaker, the two of you are, do you think that the urban legend, that it has a purpose in, does it serve as a warning to people? Like I found as a child that these legends were, they were stories, but they were almost warnings to me, like to watch out or maybe be careful, not be so trusting of people, especially clowns. But I, you know, it really did serve as a warning to me, not just something that was meant to shock me for the value of shock, but almost as a way to teach a lesson, or I don't know. That's the way I took it as a child. As an adult looking back on it, I think it was a valuable lesson to me, especially, like you said, the evil that men do, to realize that it's not just stories. This could be the guy next door, the person down the street, a stranger that walks up to you on a darkened road. And I know as a filmmaker, do you find that that these are important as to get a message across?
Yeah, I mean, urban legends, it's easy to say that an urban legend, when you boil it down, is just a cautionary tale, right? I mean, the best example is the hook for hand, is you know, don't go to Lover's Lane, you're going to get killed. You know, don't have premarital sex, it'll kill you. You know, I mean, with the babysitter, you know, it's a cautionary tale. I mean, there could be various reasons, but a cautionary tale of, you know, you better go check the children. This is your responsibility. If you weren't paying attention, you're going to get killed. You know, it's definitely a function of the urban legend. With clowns, it's just freaking creepy. You know, don't trust, you know, I think that's just, you know, more on the surface of what is hiding behind this mask. You know, it's not necessarily a cautionary tale, but it's like there is something hiding there, and we should be suspicious, you know, and then that goes into stranger danger, you know?
Yeah. And even, I think, Rach, we even found on top of that, when you look at films like Candyman, which also bring in another element, which is, you know, the Candyman deals with specifically Cabrini Green, which was, you know, a housing development. And so, as we say in the film, like, how do you talk to children about institutional racism? How do you talk to them about people who are poor who can't seem to get out of the situation that they're in? You know, the only thing you can do as a child is to kind of put all those larger societal issues into a monster and blame it on the monster. And so you blame it on the Candyman. And in a lot of ways, clowns was that guy. You know, how do you talk about pedophiles, and how do you talk about things you don't quite understand? Well, just blame it on the clown. It's easy to put it onto the clown. And so that's, I think, what we especially did back in the 70s and 80s with Stranger Danger, for sure.
Well, and these cautionary tales, I mean, there's nothing new about that at all. You know, you have your water spirits, you know, tales, because you want those families, you want those mothers to keep an eye on those babies, and you know, don't let them drown in the river. And the best way to or lake or whatever the case may be, and if they are so fearful that something is literally going to come out of the water and grab the baby, then that gives it, you know, an extra layer of attention. And I think that's, those kinds of stories have been going on forever. What I was thinking about, actually, when all three of you were talking, I was wondering if we, in a sense, almost have it reversed, where the story is already there. That you were talking about Jungian earlier, that archetype is already there, and we just kind of have to wait for reality to come along so that we can plug it in. Does that make any sense?
You're very right in that respect. So now I'll ask you, the Slender Man. Okay, that's a very
new Slender Man because it's so new.
Okay, so new. So what is it trying to teach us? What is Slender Man trying to teach us? Now, who really knows? And everybody has a different idea. What I love about Slender Man is it's an internet created reality.
Yes,
it's an internet created monster. And so to me, Slender Man, it goes back to the Jungian. It goes, you know, like if you talk about the stories like, oh, it goes back to, you know, Germany in the 1920s and 30s, you know, but it's not really about Germany in the 1920s and 30s. To me, it's about the internet, and it's about our manipulation of pictures and reality to create this figure. And what it says to me is be careful of the internet. Be careful of what you don't quite know or don't quite see on the internet, because we can all make ourselves be something that we're not. That's what I
think you are 1,000% correct about that. And I, again, just because I think about this stuff all the time, you know, Slender Man's one of my, you know, 85 Google alerts. And, you know, I mean, look how popular the games are. You know, I don't even play video games, but there's so many of them, and they're super popular. And then you also have these kind of internet-only films that people have made. So in this very short time, which shows how things have changed with the digital communication explosion, which really just is so recent a development, but it just shows how much faster and faster and faster that these things can take off and become so ingrained. Speaking of Slender Man, what interests me, other than just he's such a really almost perfectly evolved, creepy figure, I mean, visually, kind of combining several different elements that are all creepy in their own regard, the no face, the really long, long limbs, you know, the lurking, many, many elements, even the formal attire. So you're almost bringing in a Men in Black kind of element to it. You know, all of that's perfect. But what's really interests me in particular is my daughter came to me about, I don't know, I'm sure it's at least a year, it may even be 2 years ago now. So she's 14, so she probably was 12, and I think it actually was when she was in sixth grade. And she came to me just out of nowhere, nothing to do with what I was writing about or what I was interested in, and she doesn't pay that much attention, you know, she doesn't care. So she came to me and said that in one of her classes that they had talked the entire class about Slender Man, and that the teacher hadn't really known anything about him before the discussion, but became fascinated, and that kids, you know, got on the computer and were showing the teacher all of these various iterations and manifestations, and not one of those kids, the teacher was able to rather quickly, I think in the course of that hour even, get on the computer, get on the internet, do some quick research, find out where he came from. But not one of those kids, every single one of those kids knew Slender Man, you know, was well acquainted and either played the games or watched the videos or whatever. Not one of those kids knew that Slender Man was not real and was very recent and had come directly from the internet. So, I mean, that answers your question or proves your point right there. Not one of these kids knew the source of Slender Man, and they were talking about him. They knew all kinds of facts about him. None of them knew he wasn't real, or none of them were sure he wasn't real, and none of them knew that he had actually, you know, literally been created on the internet. And that was, I agree with you. It's very interesting because even in their ignorance, the kids do know that there are things going on the internet that are dangerous. And not just dangerous in the way that parents are always bugging them and they're cautionary and, be careful who you're talking to. But they viscerally know there's something going on out there and that there's some sort of collective identity to it. And that in and of itself is dangerous and or frightening.
Well, what I love is that to me, there's a lot of parts of Slender Man that work for the internet. Number one, long arms, long legs. What that proves to me, the tentacles are the long reach of the internet. Like, it can be anywhere, and it could come to you, and there's all these different ways. Number two, faceless, obviously. The perpetrator who may be on the other side of the internet, we don't really know who they are. We can't see them. They're just an email address. Yet at the same time, the formal attire that you talk about, there's an internet address. There's some kind of theoretical proof behind it. So there's all these, to me, these things that work about it. Yet at the same time, we've created great stories to make it work. For example, well, what are the long arms in the Slender Man story? Oh, he was a pedophile who was pulled limb from limb, and that's how he got the long arms. You know, so I love how we still create the stories that make, as you say, the urban legend work. We're just waiting for the story to come along. The fear is there. We're just waiting to create the best story possible. And when we find that best story possible, when we make him have formal attire or we make him faceless and we're like, yeah, that really works for the internet, then we go with it. You know, then we lock
Dude,
on.
Dude, your next movie, right there.
Right? I know, right? So, in fact, we were always talking about that our next one was going to be the real history. There's two of them we like. Number one, Slender Man. Number two, what is it, Smiley, the Smiley Face Killer. Because we don't
right.
quite know where that one comes from. So that's another one that really interests us.
And now, if you've noticed, lately they're interacting a lot. You know, they're fighting.
Mm-hmm.
They duke it out, you know. Who's going to win? I'll read this whole page, you know, on a message board where they're literally getting into the details of why one would prevail in a fight over the other, as if it is 100% real. It just cracks me up. I think that's the other part about the internet that I find so fascinating, because I am older, and because it still feels like a kind of recent thing to me. I mean, I'm
right.
55, so, you know,
right.
I mean, I was alive a long time before there was an internet. And
right.
what amazes me about it is all of the games and the role-playing and how that side of it just bleeds with, I mean, it's such a huge gray area, and people are really forgetting, especially kids, of course, but I don't think it's only kids. They're forgetting how to distinguish between quote-unquote reality and game playing or role playing. And I think the more sophisticated and evolved these games get, the more that's just going to keep happening. And eventually, I mean, I guess, you know, we're told by futurists and scientists or whatever, we'll all just get sucked up into computers, and that's how we're going to live.
Well, to me, the internet is just one great campfire. And around the campfire is where we tell our stories. And so it's just a different – all it is again, it's a different mode, and it's a different – place, and it's a different setting where the lights are low and it's dark outside and there's a campfire and we're all sitting around it and we're telling our stories, and just the internet allows for that to happen.
And by reducing, makes it that much more immediate, because it reduces the distance factor and the time factor, and it makes it, you know, so that people can literally have these experiences collectively at the same time, by the dozens or hundreds or thousands or even millions all at once.
But how great is that?
And, of course,
that?
We've had mass media, you know, for a while. We've had television, certainly, and
sure.
radio. But this is different.
But I love it.
It's interactive.
I love it. You know, now like, we've got, you know, now it's not just 10 Boy Scouts around the campfire. It's a million people. Think of the power of that.
Hey, now, Josh, speaking of the power of that, now this might be a little far-fetched, but I am, you know, by trade a paranormal investigator, and I've seen things that make me believe in lots of things are possible, things that I never thought were possible before I feel are possible, and this whole urban legend tripping, these stories, and the statement you just said about how powerful it is now with the internet, it reminds me of I don't know what to call it, an entity called a topa, which mm-hmm. is basically a thought form that comes to life if enough people actually believe in it. They can actually create something. This is obviously not proven. This is a legend. But in many cultures, this is a real thing, a real entity, a real being. And even in paranormal investigating, we have friends that have done research on this where they have literally created a ghost. They've made up a story. They've given a backstory to a person that never was, never existed, gave them a name, a backstory, a description, and told people about this person, this ghost in this particular building. And then researchers, paranormal investigators, ghost hunters have gone out and found evidence of that. They have captured video. They have captured pictures, you know, as much as you can get in a picture, EVPs. It's incredible. And so that begs the question, is it the thought form? Was it their belief that created this? Or was it just a projection of their mind? And that's all I'm thinking about is the power in the storytelling. And with the internet, the one thing you have that you don't have when you're sitting around a campfire with a bunch of people is anonymity. You don't have to show your face. You don't have to prove it. You can say whatever without fear of being ridiculed or being said, that's not true. Or no, you have to look anybody in the face when you tell these stories. And I think it makes it that much more powerful.
I agree, Teresa. Hey, we are like your film, your two-hour film that goes by in about, you know, blink of an eye. We are plowing through this hour. What I wanted to do, obviously, we want to get back and make sure everyone has all the facts about the airing on Chiller, which is this Sunday at 8 Eastern. But I'm very interested in getting a little more background just personally on you guys. How did you arrive at this point? We know about Cropsey, of course, as far as that. But backing up a bit, you know, how did you arrive at coming together as documentary filmmakers who seem to be particularly adept at this kind of this new genre of horror documentary?
Well, you know, it does really stem from Cropsey, a lot of it, at least from my side, which is, you know, just going in and kind of looking at, you know, we look at things, I guess, Teresa, I don't know, you know, what your background is, but we look at things a little bit differently. We look at this stuff from the reality standpoint of the urban legends and matching it back to true crime. And to me, that's what's most exciting. You know, I guess we do it from just the most real sense. And I don't know, just we've always been talking to people and we've always found that they're very interested in the truth behind what they fear. And so in a lot of ways, I look at it as we're in some ways Van Helsing. And when we look at it, things from that standpoint, we like to tell people or like to help to show people what they fear. And that's how I approach it. Now, Rachel has a very different standpoint. Rachel has a very interesting history, which Rachel will tell you about. Right, Rach?
Well, I was just about to chime in on what Teresa was saying, just because of that whole aspect of, you know, I think there's parts of our mind, and, you know, I'm not a paranormal researcher, and, you know, that's not really my thing, but I grew up in knowing that our mind and unlocking things in our mind, there's a lot more there than we have any idea, and I totally believe that could actually happen, Teresa, that, you know, that... To boil it down, it's, you know, if you, you'll see it when you believe it, pretty much, you know. And so my background is pretty much growing up in I wouldn't say a cult, but I would say pseudoscience-y health cult that self-hypnosis and really visualization and things like that. But as far as Killer Legends is concerned, I come from a filmmaking background and producing documentaries and a research background. So I really came on as a researcher and really trying to find these stories and these people to tell these stories. And like I said before, that's what fascinated me and brought me on to the project.
Yeah, I mean, I
But it sounds
realized...
like your personal background gave it additional resonance.
Yeah, for and sure. Yeah, I mean, I've always been kind of on the fringe of I wouldn't say of society, but of living in a way. So, yeah, I was very, very open to the storytelling aspect. And, you know, I come from more of a fascination with science fiction more than horror because I'm more science-based, I believe, and then that goes into pseudoscience. Yeah.
It's just fascinating that in different cultures and in different countries, different parts of the world, different religions, things that maybe we would think are, you know, not possible, impossible, not real, they just accept this fact, and we find that all the time. And, you know, these are sane people. It's just their belief system. And I do appreciate that. I understand that you've come seeking the truth with the film and everything. The whole topic just reminded me of that whole idea of Atopa and the Pearl Experiment and things like
mm-hmm.
that. It the whole thing is fascinating. I guess that one way that the stories, the legends could come to life, and maybe you found this in your filmmaking, in your research, is maybe people that try to emulate these things or these legends and try to repeat things that they've done or copycat what they've done. And I know that is a truly realistic and horrifying thought that people could do this. But, you know, my husband's a police officer, and crap like that happens all the time.
Well, I mean, you watch the show or you just watch part of it, and that's all about Candyman, essentially, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't feel like we're giving it away, Josh, and I think it's very interesting to talk about it. But, you know, there's an aspect to...
Okay.
to urban legends and believing in urban legends so much that you enact it. You know, you believe that you maybe you'll get away with something because, of course, this is real, right? I know this is real. So I can go ahead and do this horrible thing because no one's going to suspect me because it's really this crazy person.
Yeah, that was the one I knew the most about, at least as far as the historical basis, just because I've kind of just become an amateur historian of Halloween. So it's been interesting how that meme about the danger in trick-or-treating has evolved. And now I've noticed for the last several years the kind of the general government or the general media angle is hey, now you need to be vigilant, of course, never be stupid, of course don't, you know, eat anything that's unwrapped, blah, blah, blah. But the truth on the ground is this is actually very, very rare. Well, I read a book, I wish I had it in front of me. It was a really well done, fairly recent history of Halloween, and in particular history of Halloween in America, and how it has evolved and how it's changed and how it's just exploded over the last 20 years or so in particular. And the guy does a really great job of teasing out those threads. There's the whole Salem, you know, Halloween Central, and the town that decided it was going to base its entire economy on Halloween. There's the evolution of the haunted houses, the haunted attractions.
Mm-hmm.
In the last 10 years, there's the TV in particular. There's the various paranormal TV shows, reality, you know, quote-unquote shows. So all those different things. But he actually ran through, and I kind of knew the story that you guys tell very well, just
mm-hmm.
from having read it in the book. And I hope I'm not giving it away, but you know, there's only proof, and it seems to be pretty well generally accepted anywhere I've looked, that there really only has ever been one death due to poisoning. And that is the story that you guys tell. And it is as horrific as
mm-hmm.
any horror story. And I want to, just before I forget, because my brain forgets things, one of the great or thought-provoking lines of thought in your film is saying one of the reasons that we cling to these stories beyond kind of the more, I suppose, esoteric and archetypal cultural things that we've been talking about more so in the last hour, but that people cling to kind of more on a surface level is no matter how bad that story is, the urban legend story, people mm-hmm. have to make changes to the real story as if they cannot control themselves, because to keep the facts exactly right the way they happened, it's just too horrifying. It's too frightening. It's actually easier if we make some changes in those tales so that they do become a little less specific. And I think that was a really extremely interesting and yet another line of insight in the show. But, Teresa, you probably know, you know, given your interest in Halloween, this story. This is from the – what decade? Is that the 70s?
74.
Yeah, and one of the angles you guys explore in this, and this is kind of how I got into it in the first place and why the author of the Halloween book was talking about it, is it really did, in a sense, kill Halloween, at least for a while.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, what's so interesting to us is that the guy was actually caught because he believed the urban legend. You know, here you have it's called ostension, which is acting upon the urban legend as if it was real. And this guy poisoned his child, believing that numerous kids had been actually killed with Halloween candy. He didn't know that it was just an urban legend. And so when the police investigated him, and you know, when he said, you know, oh, he's killed by Halloween candy, police said, well, actually, that's not true. There is no actual real case of a child being poisoned by Halloween candy, and you're busted. So, you know, that
was ironic.
That's what makes it so fascinating, is the fact that, in a sense, you're right. We need to create monsters because the truth is, in fact, much more horrific than we could ever imagine. And that case specifically was just so interesting in the fact that we want to believe that there is some unexplained reason. We want to believe in the mysterious other. We want to believe that there is the other. In that case, it's called the Halloween sadist. And in fact, it's not real. You know, there is no Halloween sadist.
Well, what I find so interesting about that urban legend, the urban legend of tainted candy, of razor blades and apples, is that, I mean, we didn't include this in the film necessarily, but we did shoot a lot of, like, man on the street talking about different urban legends. You know, have you heard about an urban legend about a babysitter? Have you heard about an urban legend about a clown? Whenever we said, what about tainted candy? Almost, it was interesting. There weren't a lot of people who really kind of considered that as an urban legend. And that kind of just speaks to how this person thought he was going to get away with it, because it's so ingrained in us. I mean, I'm sure all of us who are on the phone right now had to check Halloween candy, either ourselves or, you know, our children. You know, it's so ingrained. That's the one urban legend out of all four of these that I think people actually think, well, that's not an urban legend. That actually happens.
Why take the chance if you have children, you know?
Exactly.
I mean, that irritated me as a child. Now, as a mother, I'm like, I'm checking every piece of your candy just in case. And, yeah, well, I mean, it's fine. It's changed Halloween.
What's funny mm-hmm. is the guy, the expert, his name is Joel Best, and he's the expert on the truth about Halloween candy. And even he checks his own children's candy, even though he knows that technically there's never been a substantiated case of anybody being poisoned by a stranger mm-hmm. doing Halloween candy. And every year, he says, every year they come to me and they ask me, you know, is it real? And every year I tell them it's not real, and yet every year they come back to me over and mm-hmm. over again keep thinking that it's real. He tells everybody it's not real, yet it's so ingrained in people that it is real. But that also goes back to the clown thing. I mean, you know, there's no technical substantiated thing to make us fear clowns except for Gacy. And Gacy didn't act when he was killing people. He never dressed up as a clown when he was killing people, although numerous, you know, movies have dictated so. But yet clowns have become this ubiquitous monster in our society. And so it's just very interesting how society, you can tell them all the truth that they want. They won't mm-hmm. listen. When they want a monster, they're going to make that monster quite real no matter what you say.
And then it is not unlikely that created reality will then manifest somewhere along the line into real reality. And I think that's why we do keep checking that candy, because just because it hasn't happened doesn't mean it isn't ever going to happen.
Well, because then you have copycats, which is the other thing. In all these urban legends, the one thing that everybody says at the end of it, yes, they said, okay, well, it's never quite happened, but what about a copycat? Is it going to happen? And we can never, you know, we can never not talk about copycats as being real, because they are real, and they will eventually happen. If we talk about something enough, you know, listen, you know, when John Holmes went in and shot up that movie theater, he did it because of the Joker movie. And yes, I know we don't like to say, like, somebody does something because of a movie, and it's unfair to say that movies promote violence because technically they don't, but yet, he did it because of the scenario that was created. So the thing we don't have to necessarily fear is the monster itself, but yet getting back to it, what we take of that monster, how we make those monsters real, unfortunately.
And what you guys say, which is yet another brilliant line, perceptive line in 2 hours of them, and that is, it's not the story, but the storyteller. Ooh, that gave me chills. All right, guys. Well, we have passed the hour mark. Amazing stuff. Fascinating conversation. I could certainly go on and on. And seriously, man, you got to bring me in on that Slender Man thing if you make that.
We will.
You got to bring me as an expert commentator or whatever. I'll tell the story about my daughter. Because I'm fascinated by that, and I think I couldn't agree more. I mean, we arrived at very similar perspectives on that completely independently. All right, but we need to let everyone know, coming Sunday, this very Sunday, debuting the 16th at 8 p.m. Eastern on Chiller, 2-hour special, Killer Legends. Been talking about it for an entire hour. It has gone really quickly, could go on and on and on, as I've said, and we'd love to have you guys back on down the road. Let's also let people know how they can get a hold of you. Where can people find you guys if they're looking for you?
Probably the Cropsy Facebook is great. That's where we've been promoting Killer Legends. I know for Josh, your Twitter handle is Josh Seaman. Yeah, and mine is Mills Rachel.
Ooh, clever reversal.
And we love, you know, listen, you know, one of the things is we love to talk. You know, for me, it's not just about the show itself, obviously. It's about the conversation that happens beyond the show. I mean, you know, it's never about just the show. And if you're making a show for just what that is, then you're not really talking about urban legends in the way that they need to be discussed. Urban legends need to be talked around, they need to be discussed in a forum outside of just, you know, the show itself. And that's what's most exciting to me. I love it when people say, you know, I saw the show, but then I went on the internet and checked it out on Google. And that's what we love. So please come talk to us. You know, we'll talk to you all about the urban legends and even about your own urban legends in your own hometown. We'd love to hear that stuff.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. Well, excellent job on it. I hope it's a huge hit. I am certain it will be very well received. It is both compelling from a filmic standpoint. It's very entertaining and absorbing and thought-provoking. It's everything it should be.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
Thank you so much.
My
Looking
pleasure.
Looking forward to watching the show, and thanks for being our guest tonight, guys, and I hope you get to make lots and lots of more movies and find the truth behind more urban legends.
There you go. Thanks so much.
All right. Well, thank you, everyone, for listening, of course, and we will be back next week. We're actually booked up pretty well here for quite a while, more than usual. We probably have the next four or five shows booked out. Lots of really interesting people coming around. We keep varying things a little bit more and more. This one was really interesting. I have lots of stuff for me to go back and kind of think about beyond the film, but just some of the underlying issues and how interactive society and art have become. It's really fascinating stuff. All right. Well, again, best of luck. Best wishes to you guys.
Thank you.
Love to stay in touch, and I'll be really interested to see what the public reaction to the film is, because I think it's outstanding, and I think people really will I think it will strike people on layers that they're not even anticipating.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we hope so. You know, the interesting thing is that, you know, there's been so many Ghost Hunter shows, and we're trying to do something a little bit different. And we're trying to speak to the audience in a slightly different way. And so hopefully, you know, guys, if you like the show, please let everybody know, let Chiller know, and hopefully, you know, we can keep making more.
Outstanding. That would be wondrous. Great stuff. All right. Thank you so much. Have a great evening, you guys. Listeners, thank you so much. We'll talk to you next week. And Teresa, have a great night.
All right. Good night, everyone.
Thanks, guys.
All right. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you.